again, not near the train tracks, then mingle with the church folk. When the next bus came, he'd be gone. I glanced to my right just in time to see him emerging from the alley. The camera was back in the paper sack. He went to the bus stop and leaned against the post. A man came along and asked him something. Soon they were in conversation. Batting the breeze with a stranger? Or was this perhaps another friend of de Morenschild's? Just some guy on the street? Or a co-conspirator? Maybe even the famous unknown shooter who, according to the conspiracy theorists, had been lurking on the grassy knoll near Dealey Plaza when Kennedy's motorcade approached. I told myself that was crazy, but it was impossible to know for sure. That was the hell of it. There was no way of knowing anything for sure, and wouldn't be until I saw with my own eyes that Oswald was alone on April 10th. Even that wouldn't be enough to put all my doubts to rest, but it would be enough to proceed on. Enough to kill Junie's father. The bus came growling up to the stop. Secret Agent X-19, also known as Lee Harvey Oswald, the renowned Marxist and wife-beater, got on. When the bus was out of sight, I went back to the alley and walked its length. At the end, it widened out into a big unfenced backyard. There was a 57 or 58 Chevy Biscayne parked beside a natural gas pumping station. There was a barbecue pot standing on a tripod. Beyond the Barbie was the backside of a big dark brown house, the General's house. I looked down and saw a fresh drag mark in the dirt. A garbage can stood at one end of it. I hadn't seen Lee move the can, but I knew he had. On the night of the 10th, he meant to rest the rifle barrel on it. On Monday, March 25th, Lee came walking up Neely Street carrying a long package wrapped in brown paper. Peering through a tiny crack in the curtains, I could see the words registered and insured stamped on it in big red letters. For the first time, I thought he seemed furtive and nervous, actually looking around at his exterior surroundings instead of at the spooky furniture deep in his head. I knew what was in the package, a 6.5mm Carcano rifle, also known as a Mannlicher Carcano, complete with scope, purchased from Klein's Sporting Goods in Chicago. 5 minutes after he climbed the outside stairs to the second floor, the gun Lee would use to change history was in a closet above my head. Marina took the famous pictures of him holding it just outside my living room window 6 days later, but I didn't see it. That was a Sunday, and I was in Jody. As the 10th grew closer, those weekends with Sadie had become the most important, the dearest things in my life. I came awake with a jerk, hearing someone mutter, "Still not too late," under his breath. I realized it was me, and shut up. Sadie murmured some thick protest and turned over in bed. The familiar squeak of the springs locked me in place and time. The Candlewood Bungalows, April 5th, 1963. I fumbled my watch from the nightstand and peered at the luminous numbers. It was 2:15 in the morning, which meant it was actually the 6th of April. Still not too late. Not too late for what? To back off? To let well enough alone? Or bad enough, come to that? The idea of backing off was attractive, God knew. If I went ahead and things went wrong, this could be my last night with Sadie. Ever. Even if you do have to kill him, you don't have to do it right away. True enough. Oswald was going to relocate to New Orleans for a while after the attempt on the General's life. Another shitty apartment, one I'd already visited, but not for 2 weeks. That would give me plenty of time to stop his clock. But I sensed it would be a mistake to wait very long. I might find reasons to keep on waiting, The best one was beside me in this bed, long, lovely, and smoothly naked. Maybe she was just another trap laid by the obdurate past. But that didn't matter, because I loved her. And I could envision a scenario all too clearly where I'd have to run after killing Oswald. Run where? Back to Maine, of course, hoping I could stay ahead of the cops just long enough to get to the rabbit hole and escape into a future where Sadie Dunhill would be, well, about 80 years old, if she were alive at all. Given her cigarette habit, that would be like rolling six the hard way. I got up and went to the window. Only a few of the bungalows were occupied on this early spring weekend. There was a mud or manure-splattered pickup truck with a trailer full of what looked like farm implements behind it, an Indian motorcycle with a sidecar, a couple of station wagons, and a two-tone Plymouth Fury. The moon was sliding in and out of thin clouds, and it wasn't possible to make out the color of the car's lower half by that stuttery light, but I was pretty sure I knew what it was, anyway. I pulled on my pants, undershirt, and shoes. Then I slipped out of the cabin and walked across the courtyard. The chilly air bit at my bed-warm skin, but I barely felt it. Yes, the car was a Fury. And yes, it was white over red. But this one wasn't from Maine or Arkansas. The plate was Oklahoma, and the decal in the rear window read Go Sooners. I peeked in and saw a scatter of textbooks. Some student, maybe headed south to visit his folks on spring break, or a couple of horny teachers taking advantage of the Candlewood's liberal guest policy. Just another not quite on-key chime, as the past harmonized with itself. I touched the trunk, as I had back in Lisbon Falls, then returned to the bungalow. Sadie had pushed the sheet down to her waist, and when I came in, the draft of cool air woke her up. She sat holding the sheet over her breasts, then let it drop when she saw it was me. "Can't sleep, honey?" I had a bad dream and went out for some air. "What was it?" I unbuttoned my jeans, kicked off my loafers. "Can't remember." "Try. My mother always used to say if you tell your dreams, they won't come true." I got into bed with her wearing nothing but my undershirt. "My mother used to say if you kiss your honey, they won't come true." "Did she actually say that?"
"No."
"Well," she said thoughtfully, "it sounds possible. Let's try it."
We tried it. One thing led to another.
Afterward, she lit a cigarette. I lay watching the smoke drift up and turn blue in the occasional moonlight coming through the half-drawn curtains. I'd never leave the curtains that way at Neely Street, I thought. At Neely Street in my other life, I'm always alone, but still careful to close them all the way. Except when I'm peeking, that is, lurking. Just then I didn't like myself very much. "George?" I sighed.
"That's not my name."
"I know." I looked at her. She inhaled deeply, enjoying her cigarette guiltlessly, as people do in the land of a go. "I don't have any inside information, if that's what you're thinking, but it stands to reason. The rest of your past is made up, after all. And I'm glad. I don't like George all that much. It's kind of, what's that word you use sometimes? Kind of dorky."
"How does Jake suit you?"
"As in Jacob?"
"Yes."
"I like it." She turned to me. "In the Bible, Jacob wrestled an angel. And you're wrestling too, aren't you?"
"I suppose I am, but not with an angel.
Although Lee Oswald didn't make much of a devil either. I like George de Morenschild better for the devil role. In the Bible, Satan's a tempter who makes the offer and then stands aside. I hoped de Morenschild was like that."
Sadie snubbed her cigarette. Her voice was calm, but her eyes were dark.
Are you going to be hurt?
I don't know.
Are you going away? Because if you have to go away, I'm not sure I can stand it. I would have died before I said it when I was there, but Reno was a nightmare. Losing you for good? She shook her head slowly. No, I'm not sure I could stand that.
I want to marry you, I said.
My God, she said softly. Just when I'm ready to say it'll never happen, Jake, alias George, says right now.
Not right now, but if the next week goes the way I hope it does, will you?
Of course, but I do have to ask one teensy question.
Am I single? Legally single? Is that what you want to know?
She nodded.
I am, I said. She let out a comic sigh and grinned like a kid. Then she sobered.
Can I help you? Let me help you.
The thought turned me cold, and she must have seen it. Her lower lip crept into her mouth. She bit down on it with her teeth.
That bad, then, she said musingly.
Let's put it this way.
I'm currently close to a big machine full of sharp teeth, and it's running full speed. I won't allow you next to me while I'm monkeying with it.
When is it? She asked.
Your date with destiny?
Still to be determined. I had a feeling that I'd said too much already, but since I'd come this far, I decided to go a little farther.
Something's going to happen this Wednesday night. Something I have to witness. Then I'll decide.
Is there no way I can help you?
I don't think so, honey.
If it turns out I can.
Thanks, I said. I appreciate that. And you really will marry me?
Now that I know your name is Jake?
Of course.
On Monday morning around 10 o'clock, the station wagon pulled up at the curb and Marina went off to Irving with Ruth Payne. I had an errand of my own to run and was just about to leave the apartment when I heard the thump of footsteps descending the outside stairs. It was Lee, looking pale and grim. His hair was mussy and his face was stippled with a bad breakout of post-adolescent acne. He was wearing jeans and an absurd trench coat that flapped around his shins. He walked with one arm across his chest, as if his ribs hurt, or as if he had something under his coat.
Before the attempt, Lee sighted in his new rifle somewhere out by Love Field,
Al had written. I didn't care where he sighted it in. What I cared about was how close I'd just come to meeting him face to face. I'd made the careless assumption that I'd missed him going off to work, and why wasn't he at work on a Monday morning, come to that? I dismissed the question and went out carrying my school briefcase. Inside were the never-to-be-finished novel, Al's notes, and the work in progress describing my adventures in the land of Ago. If Lee wasn't alone on the night of April 10th, I might be spotted and killed by one of his co-conspirators, maybe even De Morenschild himself. I still thought the odds of that were unlikely, but the odds of having to run away after killing Oswald were better. So were the odds of being captured and arrested for murder. I didn't want anyone, the police, for instance, finding Al's notes or my memoir if either of those things happened. The important thing to me on that 8th of April was to get my paperwork out of the apartment and far away from the confused and aggressive young man who lived upstairs. I drove to the First Corn Bank of Dallas and was not surprised to see that the bank official who helped me bore a striking resemblance to the hometown trust banker who had helped me in Lisbon Falls. This guy's name was Link instead of Deucen, but he still looked like the old-time Cuban bandleader, Xavier Cugat. I inquired about safe deposit boxes. Soon enough, the manuscripts were in box 775. I drove back to Neely Street and had a moment of severe panic when I couldn't find a goddamn key to the box. Relax, I told myself. It's in your pocket somewhere, and even if it isn't, your new pal, Richard Link, will be happy to give you a duplicate. Might cost you all of a buck. As if the thought had summoned it, I found the key hiding way down in the corner of my pocket under my change. I put it on my key ring, where it would be safe. If I did have to run back to the rabbit hole and stepped into the past again after a return to the present, I'd still have it, although everything that had happened in the last 4.5 years would reset. The manuscripts now in the safe deposit box would be lost in time. That was probably good news. The bad news was that Sadie would be, too. Chapter 22. The afternoon of April 10th was clear and warm, a foretaste of summer. I dressed in slacks and one of the sports coats I'd bought during my year teaching at Denholm Consolidated. The .38 police special, fully loaded, went into my briefcase. I don't remember being nervous. Now that the time had come, I felt like a man encased in a cold envelope. I checked my watch. 3:30. My plan was to once more park in the Alpha Beta lot on Wycliffe Avenue. I could be there by 4:15 at the latest, even if the crosstown traffic was heavy. I'd scope out the alley. If it was empty, as I expected it would be at that hour, I'd check the hole behind the loose board. If Al's notes were right about Lee stashing the Carcano in advance, even though he'd been wrong about the place, it would be there. I'd go back to my car for a while, watching the bus stop just in case Lee showed up early. When the 7 p.m. newcomer service started at the Mormon church, I'd stroll to the coffee shop that served breakfast all day and take a seat by the window. I would eat food I wasn't hungry for, dawdling, making it last, watching the buses arrive and hoping that when Lee finally got off one, he'd be alone. I would also be hoping not to see George de Morenschild's boat of a car. That, at least, was the plan. I picked up my briefcase, glancing at my watch again as I did so, 3:33. The Chevy was gassed and ready to go. If I'd gone out and gotten into it then, as I'd planned to, my phone would have rung in an empty apartment. But I didn't, because someone knocked at the door just as I reached for the knob. I opened it, and Marina Oswald was standing there. For a moment I just gaped, unable to move or speak. Mostly it was her unexpected presence, but there was something else as well. Until she was standing right in front of me, I hadn't realized how much her wide blue eyes looked like Sadie's. Marina either ignored my surprised expression or didn't notice it. She had problems of her own. "Please excuse, have you seen my Hubka?" She bit her lips and shook her head a little. "Hubspun?" She attempted to smile, and she had those nicely refurbished teeth to smile with, but it still wasn't very successful. "Sorry, sir, don't speak good English. I'm Bielorussia." I heard someone, I guess it was me, ask if she was talking about the man who lived upstairs. "Yes, please, my husband Lee. We live upstairs. This our Malushka, our baby." She pointed at June, who sat at the bottom of the steps in her walker, contentedly sucking on a pacifier. "He go out now old times since he lose his work." She tried to smile again, and when her eyes crinkled, a tear spilled from the corner of the left one and tracked down her cheek. So, old Bobby Stovall could get along without his best photoprint technician after all, it seemed. "I haven't seen him, Mrs. Oswald," almost jumped out, but I held it back in time. And that was good, because how would I know? They got no home delivery, it seemed. There were two mailboxes on the porch, but their name wasn't on either of them. Neither was mine. I got no home delivery either. "Oswald," she said, and held out her hand. I shook it, more convinced than ever that this was a dream I was having. But her small dry palm was all too real. "Marina Oswald, I am, please, to meet you, sir. I'm sorry, Mrs. Oswald. I haven't seen him today. Not true. I'd seen him go out just after noon, not long after Ruth Payne's station wagon swept Marina and June away to Irving.
I'm worried for him, she said. I don't know. Sorry. No mean bother for you.
She smiled again, the sweetest, saddest smile, and wiped the tear slowly from her face. If I see him... Now she looked alarmed.
No, no, say nothing. He don't like me talk to strangers. He come home super, maybe, for sure.
She walked down the steps and spoke Russian to the baby, who laughed and held out her chubby arms to her mother.
Goodbye, Mr. Sir. Many thanks. You say nothing?
Okay, I said. Mum's the word. She didn't get that, but nodded and looked relieved when I put my finger across my lips. I closed the door, sweating heavily. Somewhere I could hear not just one butterfly flapping its wings, but a whole cloud of them. Maybe it's nothing. I watched Marina push June's stroller down the sidewalk toward the bus stop, where she probably meant to wait for her husband, who was up to something. That much she knew. It had been all over her face. I reached for the doorknob when she was out of sight, and that was when the phone rang. I almost didn't answer it, but there were only a few people with my number, and one of them was a woman I cared about very much. Hello?
Hello, Mr. Amberson, a man said. He had a soft southern accent. I'm not sure if I knew who he was right away. I can't remember. I think I did.
Someone here has something to say to you.
I lived two lives in late 1962 and early 1963, one in Dallas and one in Jody. They came together at 3:39 on the afternoon of April 10th. In my ear, Sadie began screaming. She lived in a single-story prefab ranch on Beetree Lane, part of a four- or five-block development of houses just like it on the west side of Jody. An aerial photograph of the neighborhood in a 2011 history book might have been captioned Mid-Century Starter Homes. She arrived there around 3 o'clock that afternoon, following an after-school meeting with her student library aides. I doubt if she noticed the white over red Plymouth Fury parked at the curb a little way down the block. Across the street, four or five houses down, Mrs. Holloway was washing her car, a Renault Dauphin that the rest of the neighbors eyed with suspicion. Sadie waved to her when she got out of her VW Bug. Mrs. Holloway waved back. The only owners of foreign and somehow alien cars on the block, they were casually collegial. Sadie went up the walk to her front door and stood there for a moment, frowning. It was ajar. Had she left it that way? She went in and closed it behind her. It didn't catch because the lock had been forced, but she didn't notice. By then, her whole attention was fixed on the wall over the sofa. There, written in her own lipstick, were two words in letters 3 feet high. Dirty cunt. She should have run then. But her dismay and outrage were so great that she had no room for fear. She knew who had done it. But surely Johnny was gone. The man she had married had little taste for physical confrontation. Oh, there had been plenty of harsh words and that one slap, but nothing else. Besides, her underwear was all over the floor. It made a rough trail from the living room down the short hall to her bedroom. All of it. Full slips, half slips, bras, panties, the girdle she didn't need but sometimes wore, had been slashed. At the end of the hall, the door to the bathroom stood open. The towel rack had been ripped down. Printed on the tile where it had been, also in her lipstick, was another message. Filthy fucker. The door of her bedroom was also open. She went to it and stood in it with no sense at all that Johnny Clayton was standing behind it with a knife in one hand and a Smith & Wesson Victory 38 in the other. The revolver he carried that day was the same make and model as the one Lee Oswald would use to take the life of Dallas policeman J.D. Tippett. Her little vanity bag lay open on her bed, the contents, mostly makeup, scattered across the coverlet. The accordion doors of her closet were folded open. Some of her clothes still drooped sadly from their hangers. Most were on the floor. All of them had been slashed.
"Johnny, you bastard."
She wanted to scream those words, but the shock was too great. She could only whisper. She started for the closet, but didn't get far. An arm curled around her neck, and a small circle of steel pressed hard against her temple.
"Don't move. Don't fight. If you do, I'll kill you."
She tried to pull away, and he lashed her upside the head with the revolver's short barrel. At the same time, the arm around her neck tightened. She saw the knife in the fist at the end of the arm that was choking her and stopped struggling. It was Johnny. She recognized the voice. But it really wasn't Johnny. He had changed.
"I should have listened to him," she thought, meaning me. "Why didn't I listen?"
He marched her into the living room, arms still around her throat, then spun her and shoved her down on the couch, where she flopped, legs splayed.
"Pull down your dress. I can see your garters, you whore."
He was wearing bib overalls. That alone was enough to make her feel like she was dreaming, and had dyed his hair a weird orange blonde. She almost laughed. He sat down on the hassock in front of her. The gun was aimed at her midsection.
"We're going to call your cock boy."
"I don't know what..."
"Amberson? The one you play had the salami with in the hot sheets place over Killeen. I know all about it. I've been watching you a long time."
"Johnny, if you leave now, I won't call the police, I promise. Even though you spoiled my clothes."
"Whore clothes," he said dismissively.
I don't know his number." Her address book, the one she usually kept in her little office next to the typewriter, was lying open next to the phone.
"I do. It's on the first page. I looked under C for cockboy first, but it wasn't there. I'll place the call so you don't get any ideas about saying something to the operator. Then you talk to him."
"I won't, Johnny, not if you mean to hurt him." He leaned forward. His weird orange-blonde hair flopped into his eyes, and he brushed it away with the hand holding the gun. Then he used the knife hand to pluck the phone out of its cradle. The gun remained pointed steadily at her midsection.
"Here's the thing, Sadie," he said.
And now he sounded almost rational. "I'm going to kill one of you. The other can live. You decide which one it's going to be." He meant every word. She could see it on his face.
What if he isn't home?"
He chuckled at her stupidity. "Then you die, Sadie." She must have thought, "I can buy some time. It's at least 3 hours from Dallas to Jody, more if the traffic's heavy. Time enough for Johnny to come to his senses, maybe. Or for his attention to lapse just long enough for me to throw something at him and run out the door." He dialed 0 without looking at the address book. His memory for numbers had always been just short of perfect, and asked for Westbrook 7, 5430. Listened, said, "Thank you, operator." Then silence. Somewhere over 100 miles north, a telephone was ringing. She must have wondered how many rings Johnny would allow before hanging up and shooting her in the stomach. Then his listening expression changed. He brightened, even smiled a little. His teeth were as white as ever, she observed, and why not? He'd always brushed them at least 6 times a day.
"Hello, Mr. Amberson. Someone here has something to say to you."
He got off the hassock and handed Sadie the phone. As she put it to her ear, he slashed out with the knife, quick as a striking snake, and sliced open the side of her face.
What did you do to her?
I shouted.
What did you do, you bastard?
Hush, Mr. Amberson. He sounded amused. Sadie was no longer screaming, but I could hear her sobbing.
She's all right. She's bleeding pretty heavily, but that'll stop.
He paused, then spoke in a tone of judicious consideration. Of course, she's not going to be pretty anymore.
Now she looks like what she is, just a cheap $4 whore.
My mother said she was, and my mother was right.
Let her go, Clayton, I said. Please.
I want to let her go. Now that I've marked her, I want to. But here's what I already told her, Mr. Amberson. I'm going to kill one of you. She cost me my job, you know. I had to quit and go into an electrical treatment hospital, or they were going to have me arrested.
He paused. I pushed a girl down the stairs. She tried to touch me, all this dirty bitch's fault. This one, right here, bleeding into her lap. I got her blood on my hands, too. I will need disinfectant. Then he laughed.
Clayton,
I'll give you 3.5 hours until 7:30. Then I'll put 2 bullets in her, one in her stomach and one in her filthy cunt.
In the background, I heard Sadie scream.
Don't you do it, Jacob.
Shut up, Clayton yelled at her. Shut your mouth.
Then, to me, chillingly conversational, who's Jacob?
Me, I said. It's my middle name.
Does she call you that in bed when she sucks your cock, cock boy?
Clayton, I said. Johnny, think what you're doing.
I've been thinking about it for over a year.
They gave me shock treatments in the electric hospital, you know. They said they'd stop the dreams, but they didn't. They made them worse.
How bad is she cut? Let me talk to her.
No.
If you let me talk to her, maybe I'll do what you're asking. If you don't, I most certainly won't. Are you too fogged out from your shock treatments to understand that?
It seemed he wasn't. There was a shuffling sound in my ear, then Sadie was on. Her voice was thin and trembling.
It's bad, but it's not going to kill me.
Her voice dropped.
He just missed my eye.
Then Clayton was back.
See? Your little tramp is fine. Now, you just jump in your hot rod Chevrolet and get out here, just as fast as the wheels will roll. How would that be? But listen to me carefully, Mr. George Jacob Amberson, cockboy. If you call the police, if I see a single blue or red light, I will kill this bitch and then myself. Do you believe that?
Yes.
Good. I'm seeing an equation here where the values balance, the cockboy and the whore girl. I'm in the middle. I'm the equal sign, Amberson. But you have to decide which value gets canceled out. It's your call.
No, she screamed. Don't. If you come out here, he'll kill both of us.
The phone clicked in my ear. I've told the truth so far, and I'm going to tell the truth here, even though it casts me in the worst possible light. My first thought as my numb hand replaced the phone in its cradle was that he was wrong. The values didn't balance. In one pan of the scales was a pretty high school librarian, and the other was a man who knew the future and had, theoretically at least, the power to change it. For a second, part of me actually thought about sacrificing Sadie and going across town to watch the alley running between Oaklawn Avenue and Turtle Creek Boulevard to find out if the man who changed American history was on his own. Then I got into my Chevy and headed for Jody. Once I got out on Highway 77, I pegged the speedometer at 70, and I kept it there. While I was driving, I thumbed the latches on my briefcase, took out my gun, and dropped it into the inner pocket of my sport coat. I realized I'd have to involve Deke in this. He was old and no longer steady on his feet, but there was simply no one else. He would want to be involved, I told myself.
He loved Sadie. I saw it in his face every time he looked at her.
And he's had his life, my cold mind said. She hasn't.
Anyway, he'll have the same chance the lunatic gave you. He doesn't have to come.
But he would.
Sometimes the things presented to us as choices aren't choices at all.
I never wished so much for my long-gone cell as I did on that drive from Dallas to Jody. The best I could do was a gas station phone booth on SR 109, about a half a mile beyond the football billboard. On the other end, the phone rang three times. Four. Five. Just as I was about to hang up, Deke said,
"Hello? Hello?"
He sounded irritated and out of breath. "Deke, it's George."
"Hey, boy."
Now, tonight's version of Bill Turkett from that popular and long-running play, The Homicidal Husband, sounded delighted instead of irritated.
"I was out in my little garden beside the house. I almost let it ring, but then..."
"Be quiet and listen. Something very bad's happened. Is still happening. Sadie's been hurt. Already. Maybe a lot." There was a brief pause. When he spoke again, Deke sounded younger, like the tough man he had undoubtedly been 40 years and two wives ago. Or maybe that was just hope. Tonight, hope and a man in his late 60s was all I had.
"You're talking about her husband, aren't you? This is my fault. I think I saw him, but that was weeks ago. And his hair was much longer than in the yearbook picture. Not the same color, either. It was almost orange."
A momentary pause, and then a word I had never heard from him before.
"Fuck!"
I told him what Clayton wanted and what I proposed to do. The plan was simple enough. Did the past harmonize with itself? Fine, I would let it. I knew Deke might have a heart attack. Turkett had. But I wasn't going to let that stop me. I wasn't going to let anything stop me. It was Sadie. I waited for him to ask if it wouldn't be better to turn this over to the police, but of course he knew better. Doug Reams, the Jody constable, had poor eyesight, wore a brace on one leg, and was even older than Deke. Nor did Deke ask why I hadn't called the state police from Dallas. If he had, I would have told him I believed Clayton was serious about killing Sadie if he saw a single flashing light. It was true, but not the real reason. I wanted to take care of the son of a bitch myself. I was very angry.
"What time does he expect you, George?"
"No later than 7:30.
"And it's now 7:45 by my watch, which gives us a smidge of time. The street behind B Tree is Apple something. I disremember just what. That's where you'll be?"
"Right. The house behind hers.
I can meet you there in 5 minutes.
"Sure, if you drive like a lunatic, make it 10. And bring a prop, something he can see from the living room window if he looks out. I don't know, maybe.
Will a casserole dish do?"
"Fine. See you there in 10. Before I could hang up, he said, "Do you have a gun?"
"Yes."
His reply was close to a dog's growl.
"Good."
The street behind Doris Dunning's house had been Wymore Lane. The street behind Sadie's house was Apple Blossom Way. 202 Wymore had been for sale. 140 Apple Blossom Way had no for sale sign on the lawn, but it was dark and the lawn was shaggy, dotted with dandelions. I parked in front and looked at my watch. 6:50. 2 minutes later, Deke pulled his ranch wagon up behind my Chevy and got out. He was wearing jeans, a plaid shirt, and a string tie. In his hands, he was holding a casserole dish with a flower on the side. It had a glass lid and looked to contain 3 or 4 quarts of chop suey. "Deke, I can't thank you in..." "I don't deserve thanks. I deserve a swift kick in the pants. The day I saw him, he was coming out of the Western Auto just as I was going in. It had to have been Clayton. It was a windy day. A gust blew his hair back, and I saw those hollows at his temples for just a second. But the hair, long and not the same color. He was dressed in cowboy clothes. Shitfire!" He shook his head. "I'm getting old. If Sadie's hurt, I'll never forgive myself." "Are you feeling all right? No chest pains or anything like that?" He looked at me as if I were crazy.
Are we going to stand here discussing my health, or are we going to try to get Sadie out of the trouble she's in?
We're going to do more than try. Go around the block to her house. While you're doing that, I'll cut through this backyard, then push through the hedge and into Sadie's. I was thinking about the Dunning house on Cossett Street, of course. But even as I said it, I remembered that there was a hedge at the foot of Sadie's tiny backyard. I'd seen it many times.
You knock and say something cheery, loud enough for me to hear. By then, I'll be in the kitchen.
What if the back door's locked?
She keeps a key under the step.
Okay.
Deke thought for a moment, frowning, then raised his head.
I'll say Avon Collins special casserole delivery, and raise the dish so he can see me through the living room window if he looks. Will that do?
Yes.
All I want you to do is distract him for a few seconds. Don't you shoot if there's any chance you might hit Sadie. Tackle the bastard. You'll do okay. The guy I saw was skinny as a rail.
We looked at each other bleakly. Such a plan would work on Gunsmoke or Maverick, but this was real life. And in real life, the good guys and gals sometimes get their asses kicked or killed. The yard behind the house on Apple Blossom Way wasn't quite the same as the one behind the Dunning place, but there were similarities. For one, there was a doghouse, although no sign reading "Your pooch belongs here." Instead, painted in a child's unsteady hand over the round door-shaped entrance were the words "Butch's House" and "No trick-or-treating kitties." Wrong season. The hedge, however, looked exactly the same. I pushed through it, barely noticing the scratches the stiff branches scrawled on my arms. I crossed Sadie's backyard in a running crouch and tried the door. Locked. I felt beneath the step, sure that the key would be gone because the past harmonized, but the past was obdurate. It was there. I fished it out, put it in the lock, and applied slow, increasing pressure. There was a faint thump from inside the door when the latch sprang back. I stiffened, waiting for a yell of alarm. None came. There were lights on in the living room, but I heard no voices. Maybe Sadie was dead already and Clayton was gone. God, please no. Once I eased the door open, however, I heard him. He was talking in a loud and monotonous drone, sounding like Billy James Hargis on tranquilizers. He was telling her what a whore she was and how she'd ruined his life. Or maybe it was the girl who had tried to touch him he was talking about. To Johnny Clayton, they were all the same, sex-hungry disease carriers. You had to lay down the law. And, of course, the broom. I slipped off my shoes and put them on the linoleum. The light was on over the sink. I checked my shadow to make sure it wasn't going to precede me into the doorway. I took my gun out of my sport coat pocket and started across the kitchen, meaning to stand beside the doorway to the living room until I heard Avon calling. Then I would go in a rush. Only that isn't what happened. When Deke called out, there was nothing cheery about it. That was a cry of shocked fury. And it wasn't outside the front door. It was right in the house.
Oh, my God, Sadie!
After that, things happened very, very fast. Clayton had forced the front door lock so it wouldn't latch. Sadie didn't notice, but Deke did. Instead of knocking, he pushed it open and stepped inside with the casserole dish in his hands. Clayton was still sitting on the hassock, and the gun was still pointed at Sadie, but he had put the knife down on the floor beside him. Deke said later he didn't even know Clayton had a knife. I doubt if he really even noticed the gun. His attention was fixed on Sadie. The top of her blue dress was now a muddy maroon. Her arm and the side of the sofa where it dangled were both covered with blood. But worst of all was her face, which was turned toward him. Her left cheek hung in two flaps, like a torn curtain.
Oh, my God, Sadie!
The cry was spontaneous, nothing but pure shock. Clayton turned, upper lip lifted in a snarl. He raised the gun. I saw this as I burst through the doorway between the kitchen and the living room, and I saw Sadie piston out 1 foot, kicking the hassock.
Clayton fired, but the bullet went into the ceiling. As he tried to get up, Deke threw the casserole dish. The cover lifted off. Noodles, hamburger, green peppers, and tomato sauce sprayed in a fan. The dish, still more than half full, hit Clayton's right arm. Chop suey poured out. The gun went flying. I saw the blood. I saw Sadie's ruined face. I saw Clayton crouched on the blood-spotted rug and raise my own gun.
No! Sadie screamed. No, don't! Please don't!
It cleared my mind like a slap. If I killed him, I would become the subject of police scrutiny no matter how justified the killing might be. My George Amberson identity would fall apart, and any chance I had of stopping the assassination in November would be gone. And really, how justified would it be? The man was disarmed. Or so I thought, because I didn't see the knife either. It was hidden by the overturned hassock. Even if it had been out in the open, I might have missed it. I put the gun back in my pocket and hauled him to his feet.
You can't hit me.
Spit flew from his lips. His eyes fluttered like those of a man having a seizure. His urine let go. I heard it pattering to the carpet.
I'm a mental patient. I'm not responsible. I can't be held responsible. I have a certificate. It's in the glove compartment of my car. I'll show it to you.
The whine of his voice, the abject terror in his face now that he was disarmed, the way his dyed orange-blonde hair hung around his face in clumps, even the smell of chop suey, all of these things enraged me. But mostly, it was Sadie, cowering on the couch and drenched in blood. Her hair had come loose, and on the left side it hung in a clot beside her grievously wounded face. She would wear her scar in the same place Bobby Jill wore the ghost of hers. Of course she would. The past harmonizes. But Sadie's wound looked, oh, so much worse. I slapped him across the right side of his face, hard enough to knock spittle flying from the left side of his mouth. You crazy fuck! That's for the broom! I went back the other way, this time knocking the spit from the right side of his mouth and relishing his howl in the bitter, unhappy way that is reserved only for the worst things, the ones where the evil is too great to be taken back or ever forgiven. That's for Sadie. I balled my fist. In some other world, Deke was yelling into the phone. And was he rubbing his chest the way Turkett had rubbed his? No, at least not yet. In that same other world, Sadie was moaning. And this is for me. I drove my fist forward and I said I would tell the truth, every bit of it. When his nose splintered, his scream of pain was music to my ears. I let him go and he collapsed to the floor. Then I turned to Sadie. She tried to get off the couch, then fell back. She tried to hold her arms out to me, but she couldn't do that either. They dropped into the sodden mess of her dress. Her eyes started to roll up, and I was sure she was going to faint, but she held on.
You came, she whispered. Oh, Jake, you came for me. You both did.
Beatrice Lane, Deke shouted into the phone. No, I don't know the number. I can't remember it, but you'll see an old man with chop suey on his shoes standing outside and waving his arms. Hurry! She's lost a lot of blood.
Sit still, I said. Don't try to... Her eyes widened. She was looking over my shoulder.
Look out! Jake, look out!
I turned, fumbling in my pocket for the gun. Deke also turned, holding the telephone receiver in both of his arthritis-knotted hands like a club. But although Clayton had picked up the knife he'd used to disfigure Sadie, his days of attacking anyone were over. Anyone but himself, that is. It was another scene I'd played before, this one on Greenville Avenue, not long after I'd come to Texas. There was no muddy waters blasting from the Desert Rose, but here was another badly hurt woman and another man bleeding from another broken nose, his shirt untucked and flapping almost to his knees. He was holding a knife instead of a gun, but otherwise, it was just the same. No, Clayton, I shouted. Put it down!
His eyes, visible through clumps of orange hair, were bulging as he stared at the dazed, half-fainting woman on the couch.
"Is this what you want, Sadie?" he shouted. "If this is what you want, I'll give you what you want."
Grinning desperately, he raised the knife to his throat and cut. Part 5. 11-22-63. Chapter 23. From the Dallas Morning News, April 11, 1963, page 1. Rifleman takes shot at Walker, by Eddie Hughes. A gunman with a high-powered rifle tried to kill former Major General Edwin A. Walker at his home Wednesday night, police said, and missed the controversial crusader by less than an inch. Walker was working on his income taxes at 9 p.m. when the bullet crashed through a rear window and slammed into a wall next to him. Police said a slight movement by Walker apparently saved his life.
"Somebody had a perfect bead on him," said Detective Ira Van Cleve. "Whoever it was certainly wanted to kill him."
Walker dug out several fragments of the shell's jacket from his right sleeve and was still shaking glass and slivers of the bullet out of his hair when reporters arrived. Walker said he returned to his Dallas home Monday after the first stop of a lecture tour called Operation Midnight Ride. He also told reporters, from the Dallas Morning News, April 12, 1963, page 7, mental patient slashes ex-wife, commits suicide, by Mac Dugas. Jody. 77-year-old Deacon Deke Simmons arrived too late on Wednesday night to save Sadie Dunhill from being wounded, but things could have been much worse for the 28-year-old Dunhill, a popular librarian in the Denholm Consolidated School District. According to Douglas Reams, the Jody Town constable,
if Deke hadn't arrived when he did, Miss Dunhill almost certainly would have been killed.
When approached by reporters, Simmons would only say,
"I don't want to talk about it. It's over."
According to Constable Reams, Simmons overpowered the much younger John Clayton and wrestled away a small revolver. Clayton then produced the knife with which he had wounded his wife and used it to slash his own throat. Simmons and another man, George Amberson of Dallas, tried to stop the bleeding to no avail. Clayton was pronounced dead at the scene. Mr. Amberson, a former teacher in the Denholm Consolidated School District, who arrived shortly after Clayton had been disarmed, could not be reached for comment but told Constable Reams at the scene that Clayton, a former mental patient, may have been stalking his ex-wife for months. The staff at Denholm Consolidated High School had been alerted, and Principal Ellen Dougherty had obtained a picture, but Clayton was said to have disguised his appearance. Miss Dunhill was transported by ambulance to Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas, where her condition is listed as fair. End newspaper quotations. I wasn't able to see her until Saturday. I spent most of the intervening hours in the waiting room with a book I couldn't seem to read, which was all right because I had plenty of company. Most of the DCHS teachers dropped by to check on Sadie's condition, as did almost 100 students, those without licenses driven into Dallas by their parents. Many stayed to give blood to replace the pints Sadie had used. Soon my briefcase was stuffed with get-well cards and notes of concern. There were enough flowers to make the nurse's station look like a greenhouse. I thought I'd gotten used to living in the past, but I was still shocked by Sadie's room at Parkland when I was finally allowed inside. It was an overheated single, not much bigger than a closet. There was no bathroom. An ugly commode that only a dwarf could have used comfortably squatted in the corner, with a semi-opaque plastic curtain to pull across for semi-privacy. Instead of buttons to raise and lower the bed, there was a crank, its white paint worn off by many hands. Of course, there were no monitors showing computer-generated vital signs and no TV for the patient either. A single glass bottle of something, maybe saline, hung from a metal stand. A tube went from it to the back of Sadie's left hand, where it disappeared beneath a bulky bandage. Not as bulky as the one wrapped around the left side of her head, though.
A sheaf of her hair had been cut off on that side, giving her a lopsided, punished look. And, of course, she had been punished. The docks had left a tiny slit for her eye. It and the one on the unbandaged, undamaged side of her face fluttered open when she heard my footsteps, and although she was doped up, those eyes registered a momentary flash of terror that squeezed my heart. Then, wearily, she turned her face to the wall. "Sadie, honey, it's me." "Hi, me," she said, not turning back. I touched her shoulder, which the gown left bare, and she twitched it away. "Please don't look at me." "Sadie, it doesn't matter." She turned back. Sad, morphine-loaded eyes looked at me, one peering out of a gauze peephole. An ugly, yellowish-red stain was oozing through the bandages. Blood and some sort of ointment, I supposed. "It matters," she said. "This isn't like what happened to Bobby Jill." She tried to smile. "You know how a baseball looks, all those red stitches? That's what Sadie looks like now. They go up and down and all around. They'll fade. You don't get it?" He cut all the way through my cheek to the inside of my mouth. "But you're alive, and I love you." "Say that when the bandages come off," she said in her dull, doped-up voice. "I make the Bride of Frankenstein look like Liz Taylor." I took her hand. I read something once. "I don't think I'm quite ready for a literary discussion, Jake." She tried to turn away again, but I held onto her hand. It was a Japanese proverb. "If there is love, smallpox scars are as pretty as dimples." "I'll love your face no matter what it looks like, because it's yours." She began to cry, and I held her until she quieted. In fact, I thought she'd gone to sleep when she said, "I know it's my fault. I married him, but..." "It's not your fault, Sadie. You didn't know." "I knew there was something not right about him. And still I went ahead. I think mostly because my mother and father wanted it so badly. They haven't come yet, and I'm glad, because I blame them, too. That's awful, isn't it?" "While you're serving up the blame, save a helping for me, I saw that goddamn Plymouth he was driving at least twice dead on, and maybe a couple of other times out of the corner of my eye." "You don't need to feel guilty on that score. The state police detective and the Texas Ranger who interviewed me said Johnny's trunk was full of license plates. He probably stole them in motor courts, they said. And he had a lot of stickers. Oh, what do you call them?" "Decals." I was thinking of the one that had fooled me at the Candlewood that night. "Go Sooners." I'd made the mistake of dismissing my repeated sightings of the white over red Plymouth as just another harmonic of the past. I should have known better. I would have known better if half my mind hadn't been back in Dallas with Lee Oswald and General Walker. And if blame mattered, there was a helping for Deke, too. After all, he had seen the man, had registered those deep dimples on the sides of his forehead. "Let it go," I thought. "It's happened. It can't be undone." Actually, it could.
"Jake, do the police know you aren't quite who you say you are?"
I brushed back the hair on the right side of her face, where it was still long. "I'm fine on that score." Deke and I had been interviewed by the same policeman who interviewed Sadie before the docs rolled her into the operating room. The state police detective had issued a tepid reprimand about men who had seen too many TV westerns. The ranger seconded this, then shook our hands and said,
"In your place, I would have done exactly the same thing."
"Deke's pretty much kept me out of it. He wants to make sure the school board doesn't get pissy about you coming back next year. It seems incredible to me that being cut up by a lunatic could lead to dismissal on grounds of moral turpitude. But Deke seems to think it's best if..."
I can't go back. I can't face the kids looking like I do now.